A target in the eyes of the Spetsnaz. But you don't want to debate established military policy with me. I don't care to debate anything with you, Colonel, Orlov said. We have an operation center to launch. He started toward the door, but Roski's voice stopped him. Of course, sir. However, since you've asked to be kept aware of everything pertaining to my official activities, I will log the details of this conversation, which now include the following. The charges against your son were not dismissed. The senior sergeant's report was simply not acted upon, which isn't the same thing. If it were ever called to the attention of the personnel directorate, it would have to be acted upon. Orlov had his hand on the doorknob, his back to the colonel. My son will have to bear the consequences of his own deeds, though I'm certain a military judge would take into account his intervening years of service, as well as the way in which the records were suppressed and then released. Files sometimes show up on desks, sir. Orlov opened the door. Corporal Bielyev was standing there and saluted smartly. Your impertinence will be noted in my own log, Colonel, Orlov said. He looked from Bielyev to Roski. Would you care to add to the entry? Roski stood stiffly beside his desk. No, sir. Not at present, sir. General Orlov walked into the hall, and Bielyev entered the colonel's office. She shut the door behind her, and the general could only imagine what was taking place behind the soundproof door. Not that it mattered. Roski had been put on notice and would have to follow the rules to the letter. Though Orlov had a feeling that rules might begin to change once the colonel got Interior Minister Dugin on the phone. Chapter 15. Sunday, 10:15 p.m., Washington, D.C. Griff Agenis returned to the Oval Office.
State troopers are on the way to Forest Road, he said, and one of my teams is choppering in from New York. They'll have this lunatic before the half hour.
He won't fight them, said Burkow. Agenis sat heavily.
What do you mean?
I mean we've given him what he wants. He'll spout some radical crap and let himself be taken.
Shit, said Agenis. I really wanted to squeeze him.
Me too, said Burkow. The National Security Chief turned to Mike Rogers. Though the mood in the Oval Office was grim, Burkow owned the gravest face of the group. So, Mike, Burkow asked, who are these creatures and how do we squash the rest of them?
Before you answer, said the President, can someone tell me if the Russians have anything going militarily that can snowball into an invasion? Aren't we supposed to watch for these things?
Mel Parker, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the administration's silent man, said, While Ekdol was busy dictating terms of unconditional surrender, I rang Defense Secretary Cologne. He called the Pentagon. I'm told that several Russian divisions are on maneuvers right at the Ukrainian border. Pretty big numbers compared to what they usually do in the region, but nothing that would have sent up a warning signal.
No troop movements anywhere else? Rogers asked.
NRO is putting all their resources to finding out, Parker replied.
But the border can be a staging area, the President said.
It could very well be, said Parker.
There's the goddamn problem, said FBI Chief Agenis. All this downsizing. We have too few human resources. A satellite can't tell us about foot soldiers bitching about tomorrow's march or what it says on a map inside a field tent. That's where the real intelligence is.
That's a problem, Rogers agreed, but it has very little to do with this situation.
Ah, so? Asked Rocklin.
The truth is, said Rogers, this Groznyite didn't buy himself a thing.
What do you mean?
Asked Toby, who had been silent as she took notes for Burkow.
Assume there's an invasion, Rogers said. Say Russia goes into the Ukraine. We wouldn't intervene.
Why not?
She asked.
Because then we'd be at war with Russia, Rogers said. And what do we do next? We don't have the capacity to wage an effective conventional war. We proved that in Haiti and Somalia. If we tried, casualties would be heavy and they'd be all over TV. The public and Congress would shut us down faster than a crap game in church. And we can't go in with missiles, bombers, and big-scale attacks because of the collateral damage and civilian casualties.
I'm crying big fat Betty Boop tears, Burkow said. It's a war. People are going to get hurt. And if I'm not mistaken, the Russians fired the first salvo against a bunch of civilians in New York City.
We don't know that the Russian government authorized that, Agenis pointed out.
Exactly, said Secretary Lincoln.
And frankly, as unpopular as this might be, I'm not sure I'd want to see us fight a war for Eastern Europe, even a just one. Germany and France wouldn't join us. They might not even support us. NATO could conceivably turn on us. The expense of repelling Russia and rebuilding those nations after a war would be horrendous. No, Burkhouse said with an edge of disgust. Better to build another Maginot Line to keep the enemy out, like the three little pigs in their house of straw. I don't buy that. I believe you go to the den of the big bad wolf, napalm the bejesus out of him, and make a coat from what's left. I know that isn't the politically sensitive thing to do, but we're not the ones who started this. Tell me, Lincoln asked Rogers, did the Japanese send you a box of chocolates and a thank you note when you stopped Tokyo from being evaporated by those North Korean Nodong missiles?
I didn't do it for a pat on the back, said Rogers. I did it because it was right.
And we were all very proud of you, Lincoln said. But I still count two Americans dead versus zero Japanese.
The president said,
I'm in Mel's camp on this one, but we're losing sight of our immediate problem. Who's behind this and why?
He looked at his watch.
I'm scheduled to go on the air at 11:10 to talk about the bombing. Toby, will you have the speech updated to talk about the capture of the bomber, thanks to the fast work of the FBI, CIA, and others?
The National Security Assistant nodded and walked to the nearest phone. The President regarded Rogers.
General, is this why you advised me to capitulate to the bomber, because we were going to do what he wanted anyway?
No, sir, said Rogers. The truth is, we didn't capitulate to him. We distracted him.
Lawrence leaned back, his hands behind his head.
From what?
Our counterattack, Rogers said. Against whom? Burkhow asked. The prick told us who he was with and turned himself in.
But follow the thread backward, Rogers said.
We're listening, said the president.
Rogers leaned forward, elbows on his knees.
Sir, Grozny takes its name from Ivan Grozny, Ivan the Terrible.
Why am I not surprised, muttered Rocklin. As far back as the Revolution, they've worked for political gain, not money, Rogers said. They were fifth columnists in Germany during the war and caused some minor trouble here during the Cold War. We traced some of the early unmanned Redstone rocket failures to them.
Who finances them? Asked Parker.
Until recently, said Rogers, they were underwritten by extreme nationalistic political forces that needed terrorist enforcers. Gorbachev disbanded them in the mid-1980s, at which point they hunkered down overseas, especially in the U.S. and South America, and joined with the increasingly powerful Russian mafia in an effort to overthrow their westernized leaders.
So they must really hate Zhanyin, said Lincoln.
You've got it, said Rogers. But if they're not tied to the government, the president said, what can they be planning in Eastern Europe? A military operation of any size can't be run without the approval of the Kremlin. This isn't Chechnya, with a handful of generals in the field dictating military policy to President Yeltsin.
Hell, Rocklin observed. I never believed he wasn't calling the shots behind his hand the whole time.
That's just it, Rogers said. Something big just might be run without the Kremlin.
What we saw in Chechnya in 1994 was the beginning of a trend toward decentralization in Russia. It's a big country with 8 time zones. Suppose someone finally woke up there and said, this is like a dinosaur. It needs a couple of brains to make the whole work.
The president regarded Rogers.
Has someone, in fact, done this?
Rogers said, before the blast, Mr. President, we intercepted a bagel order sent from St. Petersburg to a shop in New York.
A bagel order? Said Burkhow. Get real.
That was my reaction, said Rogers. We noodled around with it, but it didn't make any sense until after the blast. Using the Midtown Tunnel as a point on a grid, one of our cryptologists figured out that it was a map of New York, with the tunnel as one of the highlights.
Were the other points secondary targets? Asked Agenis. After all, the World Trade Center bombers had alternate targets, including the Lincoln Tunnel.
I don't think so, said Rogers. It looked to our analyst like stops in the bomb-making process.
Now, Larry, you'll bear me out on this. For a couple of months now, we've been picking up microwave radiation from the Neva in St. Petersburg.
It's really been cooking over there, Rocklin agreed.
We thought the radiation was coming from a TV studio being built in the Hermitage, said Rogers. We now believe that the studio is a front for some kind of top-secret operation.
A second brain for the dinosaur, said Lincoln.
Exactly, said Rogers.
It was financed, apparently, using funds approved by Interior Minister Nikolai Dogin.
The loser in the elections, said the president.
The same, Rogers said. And there's one thing more. A British agent was killed trying to have a look at the place. So something is going on there. And whatever it is, whether it's a command center or military base, it's probably connected to the attack in New York through that bagel order.
So, said Av Lincoln, we have the Russian government or some faction thereof in league with an outlawed terrorist group, and quite possibly with the Russian mafia. And they apparently control enough of the military so they can make something major happen in Eastern Europe.
That's right, said Rogers.
Rockland said, God, how I'd love to grill that arrogant little Grozny rat personally when we have him.
I guarantee we won't get a thing from him, Agenis said. They wouldn't have told him anything, then let him hand himself over to us.
That would be kind of dumb, Rockland agreed. They gave him to us just so we could look good, like we wielded a swift and terrible sword of justice.
Let's not spit on that, the president said. We all know that JFK had to compromise the U.S. military in Turkey to get Khrushchev's missiles out of Cuba. The fact that only half the deal came out made him look like a hero, and Khrushchev a chump.
So, he said, let's assume that through St. Petersburg, a government official ordered the attack in New York.
Could it have been President Zhanyin?
I doubt it, said Secretary Lincoln. He wants a relationship with the West, not war. Do we know that for sure? Burkow said. Speaking of Boris Yeltsin, we've been snowed before.
Zhanyin has nothing to gain, said Lincoln. He ran against military expenditures. Besides, he and Grozny are natural-born enemies.
What about Dogin? The president asked. Can this be his doing?
He's a likelier candidate, said Rogers. He paid for the place in St. Petersburg and probably owns the people in it.
Is there any way we can talk to Zhanyin about it? Asked Toby.
I wouldn't risk it, said Rogers. Even if he's out of the loop, chances are good that not everyone around him is trustworthy.
So then what's your plan, Mike? Burkow said testily. From where I sit, one bomb has effectively put the United States on the sidelines. Christ, I remember when things like that used to galvanize people and get us into wars.
Rogers said, Steve, the bomb hasn't stopped us. From a strategic point of view, it may have helped.
How? Asked Burkow.
Whoever is behind this probably feels they don't have to watch us closely, Rogers said, just like the Russians felt about Hitler after signing the non-aggression pact.
They were wrong, said Lincoln. He attacked them anyway.
Exactly, said Rogers. He looked at the president.
Sir, let's do the same. Let me send Stryker to St. Petersburg.
As promised, we don't do anything in Eastern Europe. In fact, we let Europe tremble a little at our isolationism.
That'll certainly tie in with American sentiments these days, said Lincoln.
Meanwhile, said Rogers, we let Stryker take these people apart from the brain down.
The president looked at each man's face in turn. Rogers felt the mood in the room shift.
I like it, said Burkow, a lot.
The president stopped at Rogers' face.
Do it, he said. Bring me the head of the big bad wolf.
Chapter 16, Sunday, 8 p.m., Los Angeles. Paul Hood was sitting in a lounge beside the hotel pool. He had his pager and cellular phone by his side, and his Panama hat pulled low so he wouldn't be recognized. He didn't feel like chewing the fat with old constituents just now. Except for the conspicuously absent tan, he probably looked the part of the modern, self-absorbed independent film producer. The truth was, even with Sharon and the kids frolicking a few yards away, in the deep end of the pool, he felt melancholy and strangely alone. He had his Walkman on, listening to an all-news channel, as he waited for the president's address to the nation. It had been a long time since he'd followed a breaking news story as a citizen and not a public official, and he didn't like it. He didn't like the sense of helplessness and not being able to share his grief with the press, with other officials. He wanted to contribute to the healing or the sense of outrage or even the vengeance. He was just a man on a rubber chair waiting for news like everyone else. No, not quite like everyone else, he knew. He was waiting for Mike Rogers to call. Even though the line wasn't secure, Rogers would find a way to tell him something, assuming there was something to be told. As he waited, his thoughts returned to the bombing. The target didn't have to be the tunnel. It could just as well have been this hotel's lobby, with its Asian tourists and business people, filmmakers from Italy, Spain, South America, and even Russia. Scare them away and damage the local economy, from limousine services to restaurants. When Hood was the mayor of Los Angeles, he had participated in a number of seminars about terrorists. Though they'd all had their own methods and reasons for doing what they did, they also had one thing in common. They struck at places people had to use, whether it was a military command center or a means of transportation or an office building. That was how they brought governments to the bargaining table, despite public posturing to the contrary. He also thought about Bob Herbert, who had lost his legs and his wife in a terrorist bombing. He couldn't imagine how this was affecting him. A bleached blonde young waiter stopped by Hood's chair and asked him if he wanted a beverage. He ordered a club soda. When the waiter returned, he looked at Hood for a moment.
"You're him, aren't you?"
Hood unhooked his Walkman. "Excuse me?"
"You're Mayor Hood."
"Yes," he smiled up and nodded.
"Cool," said the young man. "I had Boris Karloff's daughter here yesterday."
He set the glass on a wobbly metal table.
"Pretty unbelievable about New York, isn't it? It's the kind of thing you don't want to think about, yet you can't not think about."
"True," said Hood. The waiter leaned closer as he poured the sparkling water.
"You'll appreciate this. Or maybe you won't.
I heard Manager Masura tell the house detective that our insurance company wants us to offer daily evacuation drills, like they do on luxury liners, just so people can't sue the chain if we get blown up."
"Protect your guests and your assets," Hood said. "Exactamundo," said the waiter.
Hood signed the bill and thanked the waiter as his phone chirped. He answered quickly. "How are you, Mike?" he asked. He picked up the phone and began walking toward a shady corner where there were no other guests.
"Same as everyone," Rogers said. "Sick and mad."
"What can you tell me?" Hood asked.
"I'm heading to the office after meeting with the boss," he said. "A lot's happened. For one thing, the perpetrator called. Gave up. We've got him."
"Just like that?" Hood asked.
"There were some strings attached," Rogers said. "We have to stay out of some business he says is going down overseas. Old Red Zone. Otherwise, we get more of the same."
"Is this big business?" Hood asked.
"We're not sure. Army business, it appears."
"From the new president?" Hood asked.
"We don't think so," Rogers said. "It appears to be a reaction to him, and not necessarily his doing."
"I see," said Hood.
"In fact, we think the okay for all this came from that TV studio we've been tuned into. Got a pretty solid paper trail. The boss has authorized us to have a look-see, pending all the paperwork. I've put Lowell on it."
Hood stopped walking under a palm tree. The president had authorized a striker excursion into St. Petersburg, and Op Center attorney Lowell Coffey II was going to seek approval from the Congressional Oversight Intelligence Committee. That was heavy duty. Hood looked at his watch. "Mike, I'm going to try and catch a red-eye back there."
"Don't," said Rogers. "We've got some time on this. When things start to hop, I can chopper you up to Sacramento and you can hitch a ride from March."
Hood looked back at the kids. They were all supposed to take the Magna studio tour in the morning. And Rogers had a point. It would be a half-hour hop up to the Air Force base, then less than a 5-hour ride back to D.C. But he had taken an oath to do a job, and it was a job, more accurately, a burden, a responsibility, which he didn't want to put on anyone else's shoulders. His heart was beating fast. Hood knew what it wanted to do. It was already getting the blood to his legs so he could make the plane. "Let me talk to Sharon," he said to Rogers.
"She's going to kill you," Rogers said. "Take a deep breath and jog around the parking lot. We can handle this."
"Thanks," Hood said, "but I'll let you know what I'm doing. I appreciate the update. I'll talk to you later."
"Sure," Rogers said glumly.
Hood clicked off and folded up the phone. He swatted it gently in his open palm. Sharon would kill him, and the kids would be crushed. Alexander had been looking forward to doing the virtual reality technophage attraction with him. "Jesus, why can't anything ever be simple?" he asked himself as he walked toward the pool.
Because then there would be no dynamics between people, he said under his breath, and life would be boring. Though he had to admit that a little boredom would be good right now. It was what he'd come back to Los Angeles in the hopes of finding.
Dad, you coming in?
His daughter Harley yelled as he approached.
No, cheesehead, said Alexander. Can't you see he's got the phone? I can't see that far without my glasses, dorko, she replied.
Sharon had stopped squirt-gunning their son and was swimming in place. From her expression, he could tell that she knew what was coming.
Gather round, Sharon said as her husband squatted by the side of the pool. I think Dad's got something to tell us.
Hood said simply, I have to go back. What happened today, we have to respond.
They need Dad to kick ass, Alexander said.
Hush, Hood said. Remember, loose lips.
Sink ships, said the 10-year-old. Excuse me, he said, as he went under.
His 12-year-old sister went to hold him there, but Alexander darted away. Sharon just glared at her husband.
This response, she asked quietly. It can't possibly be made without you.
It can.
Then let it.
I can't, Hood said. He looked down, then off to the side. Anywhere but in her eyes. I'm sorry. I'll call you later. Hood got up and called out to the kids, who interrupted their chase long enough to wave.
Get me a T-shirt at Technophage, he said.
We will,
Alexander said. He turned to walk away.
Paul,
Sharon said. He stopped and looked back.
I know this is difficult, she said, and I'm not making it any easier. But we need you, too. Especially Alexander. He's going to be, oh, Dad would have loved this, and Dad would have loved that all day tomorrow. Sometime real soon you're going to have to start responding to not being around enough.
You don't think this kills me? Hood asked.
Not enough,
Sharon said as she pushed off the side.
Not as much as being away from your electric trains in D.C. Think about it, Paul.
He would, he promised himself. In the meantime, he had a plane to catch. Chapter 17, Monday, 3:35 a.m., Washington, D.C. Lieutenant Colonel W. Charles Squires stood on the dark airstrip at Quantico. He was dressed in civilian clothes and a leather jacket, his laptop computer standing on the tarmac between his legs as he hustled the six other members of the Stryker team into the two Bell Jet Rangers that would shuttle them to Andrews Air Force Base. There, they would transfer to Stryker's private C-141B Starlifter for the 11-hour flight to Helsinki. The night was crisp and invigorating, though, as always, it was the work itself that exhilarated him the most. When he was a kid growing up in Jamaica, he had never experienced anything more exciting than running onto the soccer field before a game, especially when the odds were against his team. That was how he felt each time Stryker kicked into action. It was because of Squire's passion for soccer that Hood allowed him to name the team after the position he had played. Squires had been sleeping in his small home on the base when Rogers called, giving him his orders for the trip to Finland. Rogers apologized that they were only able to get congressional approval for a 7-person team, rather than the usual 12. Congress had to mess with everything they were given, and this time it was the roster that was paired. The thinking was, if caught, they could always explain to the Russians that they hadn't sent over a full force. In the world of international politics, distinctions like that apparently meant something. Fortunately, after the last mission, Squires had adapted Stryker's playbook to work with almost any number of team members. Squires didn't kiss his wife goodbye. Farewells were easier if she stayed asleep through them. Instead, he took the secure phone into the bathroom and talked to Rogers while he dressed. The tentative plan was for them to pose as tourists once they arrived. Once the team was airborne, Rogers would be in contact with Squires with additions or embellishments to the plan. As it stood, three operatives would go into St. Petersburg, four would wait in Helsinki as backup. The Stryker members who stayed behind would be disappointed, and they wouldn't be alone. Stryker didn't go into action often, but Squires kept them ready and finely tuned with drills, sports, and simulations. The four who remained in Helsinki would be especially frustrated to get so close and not be part of the action. But
But like any good, experienced military man, Rogers insisted on having people ready to help with a retreat, if one was necessary. After the team had boarded the Jet Rangers, Squires climbed into the second chopper. Even before it was airborne, he pulled the portable computer onto his lap, plugged in a diskette handed to him by the pilot, and began checking the equipment that was already on the Starlifter. From the weapons to clothing and uniforms of what were considered powder-keg foreign nations, countries where on-site intelligence might be necessary on short notice. China, Russia, and several Middle Eastern and Latin American nations. There was also enough underwater and cold weather gear for the entire team, though the inventory did not yet contain the still and video cameras, guidebooks, dictionaries, and commercial airline tickets they'd need if they were to pose as tourists. But Mike Rogers prided himself on his attention to detail, and Squires knew that the items would be waiting for him at Andrews. He glanced around the cabin at the strikers who had come with him. He looked from blonde, beaming David George, who had gotten bumped from their last mission when Mike Rogers took his place, to new recruit Sandra Devon, who had begun SEAL training and was recently seconded to striker to replace the man they'd lost in North Korea. As always, he felt a rush of pride as he looked at their faces, and the keen sense of responsibility that came from knowing not all of them might be coming back. Though he worked hard at what he did, he was somewhat more fatalistic than Rogers, whose motto was, "My fate's not in God's hands as long as there's a weapon in mine." Squires shifted his gaze to the computer and smiled as he pictured his wife and their young son Billy blissfully asleep. And he felt that sense of pride again, as he thought of them secure in their beds because of more than 200 years of men and women who had wrestled with the same thoughts as he did, experienced the same fears as they galloped or sailed, drove or flew off, to protect the democracy in which they all passionately believed. Chapter 18. Monday, 8:20 a.m., Washington, D.C. The small executive cafeteria was located on the ground floor of Op Center, a secure room located behind the employees' cafeteria. The walls were soundproof, the blinds were perpetually drawn, and a microwave transmitter just outside, on an unused landing strip, kept up a drone that would sound deafening to an eavesdropper. When he came aboard, Paul Hood had insisted that both cafeterias offer full fast-food-style menus, from dry eggs on a muffin to personal pizzas. This wasn't just for the convenience of Op Center employees, it was a matter of national security. During Desert Storm, the enemy had been tipped off that something was brewing by spies who kept track of the amount of takeout pizza and Chinese food that suddenly went into the Pentagon. If Op Center was put on alert for any reason, Hood didn't want a spy or journalist or anyone else finding out from a kid who delivered Big Macs on a motorbike. The executive cafeteria was always busiest between 8 and 9 in the morning. The day shift took over from the night shift at 6, and day staff spent the next 2 hours reviewing intelligence that had come in from around the world. By 8, when the data had been assimilated and filed or discarded, and barring a crisis, the directors of each division came to have breakfast and compare notes. Today, Rogers had posted email about a full staff meeting at 9, so the room would empty a few minutes before the hour to give everyone time to make it to the tank. When Press Officer Ann Ferris walked into the room, her smartly tailored red pantsuit drew an admiring nod from Lowell Coffey II. She could tell right then that he'd had an exhausting night. When Lowell was alert, he had constructive criticism about everything from fashion to literature.
"Busy night?" she asked.
"I was with the Congressional Intelligence Oversight Committee," he said, turning back to a crisply folded copy of the Washington Post.
"Ah," she said. "Long night. What happened?"
Coffey said, "Mike thinks he's got a bead on the Russians who were really behind the tunnel bombing. He sent Stryker in to get them."
"So that little Eval Ekdal man they picked up wasn't working alone?"
"Not at all," said Lowell. Anne stopped by the coffee vending machine. She fed in a dollar bill.
"Does Paul know?"
"Paul's back," he said. Anne brightened.
"Really?"
"Really and truly," said Lowell. "Caught the red eye out of L.A. Said he'll be in this morning. Mike's going to brief the entire team in the tank at 9.
Poor Paul, Anne thought as she picked up her double espresso and collected her change. Out and back in less than 24 hours. How Sharon must have loved that.
The seats around the 6 round tables were occupied by executives, doing surprisingly little. Psychologist Liz Gordon was chewing nicotine gum in the smoke-free room,
nervously twirling a lock of short brown hair, sipping her dark coffee with three sugars, and reading the new week's supermarket tabloids. Operations Support Officer Matt Stoll was playing poker with Environmental Officer Phil Katzen. There was a small mound of quarters between the men, and instead of cards, both of them were using laptops, linked by a cable. As she walked past them, Anne could tell Stoll was losing. He freely admitted that he had the worst poker face on the planet. Whenever things weren't going well, whether he was playing cards or trying to fix a computer responsible for the defense of the free world, sweat collected on every pore of his round, cherubic face. Stoll surrendered a six of spades and a four of clubs. Phil dealt him a five of spades and a seven of hearts in return.
"Well, at least I've got a higher card now," Matt said, folding. "One more hand," he said. "Too bad this isn't like quantum computing. You can find ions in a web of magnetic and electric fields, hit a trapped particle with a burst of laser light to send it into an excited energy state, then hit it again to ground it. That's your switch. Rows of ions in a quantum logical gate, giving you the smallest, fastest computer on Earth. Neat, clean, perfect."
"Yeah," Phil said. "Too bad this isn't like that." "Don't be sarcastic," Stoll said as he popped the last of a chocolate-covered donut in his mouth, then washed it down with black coffee. "Next time we'll play Baccarat and things will be different."
"No, they won't," Katzen said, sitting back as he raked in the pot.
"You always lose at that, too."
"I know," Stoll said, "but I always feel bad when I get beat playing poker. I don't know what it is."
"Loss of manhood," Liz Gordon piped in without looking up from her National Enquirer. Stoll glanced over.
"Come again?"
"Consider the elements," Liz said. "Strong hands, stone-faced bluffs, the size of the ante, the whole cigar-smoking Wild West backroom night with the boys thing." Stoll and Katzen both looked at her.
"Trust me," she said, turning the page. "I know what I'm talking about."
"Trust someone who gets their news from the tabloids," Katzen said.
"Not news," Liz said.
"Fruitcakes. Celebrities live in a rarefied atmosphere that makes them fascinating to study. As for gamblers, I used to treat chronic cases in Atlantic City. Poker and pool are two games men hate to lose. Try go fish or ping pong. They're much less damaging to the ego."
Anne sat at Liz's table.
"What about intellectual games like chess or Scrabble?" she asked.
"They're macho in a different way," Liz said. "Men don't like losing those either, but they can accept losing to a man much easier than they can to a woman."
Lowell Coffee snickered.
"Which is just what I'd expect a woman to say. You know, Senator Barbara Fox busted my chops harder last night than any man has ever done."
"Maybe she was just doing her job better than any man has ever done," Liz observed.
"No," said Coffee. "I couldn't use the kind of shorthand with her that I used with the men on the committee. Ask Martha, she was there."
Anne said, "Senator Fox has been a rabid isolationist since her daughter was murdered in France years ago."
"Look," Liz said, "all this isn't my opinion. Countless papers have been written on the subject."
"Countless papers have been written about UFOs," Coffee said, "and I still think it's all a sack of horse feathers. People respond to people, not sexes."
Liz smiled sweetly.
"Carol Laning, Lowell."
"Excuse me," Coffee said.
"I'm not allowed to talk about it," Liz said,
"but you are, if you've got the cojones."
"You mean Prosecutor Laning? Fraser v. Maryland? Is that in my psych file?"
Liz said nothing. Coffee flushed. He turned the page, creased and recreased the fold, and looked at the newspaper.
"You're barking up the wrong tree, Elizabeth. I crashed into her car by accident after the trial. It was my first case, and I was distracted. Losing to a woman had nothing to do with it."
"Of course not," Liz said.
"It's true," Coffee
said as his pager beeped. He glanced at the number, then dropped the newspaper on the table and stood.
"Sorry, kiddies, but you'll have to hear my closing argument some other time. I've got a world leader to call."
"Male or female?" Phil asked.
Coffee made a face as he left the room. When he was gone, Anne said,
"Don't you think you were a little rough on him, Liz?"
Liz finished with the National Enquirer, collected the Star and Globe, and stood. She looked down at the rosy-cheeked brunette.
A bit, Anne, but it's good for him. Despite the bluster, Lowell listens to what people say, and some of it sinks in. Unlike some people.
Thank you very much, Stoll said, as he shut his computer and disconnected the computers.
Before you got here, Anne, Liz and I were debating about whether her ineptitude with hardware was actually a physical limitation or a subconscious anti-male bias.
It's the former, Liz said. It would be the same as saying that your skills with hardware ipso facto make you a man.
Thank you again, Stoll said.
My God, Anne said. I move that we all cut back on the morning caffeine and sugar intake.
It's not that, Stoll said as Liz left. It's just the Monday after an international blow. We decided we're all a little testy because nobody thought to pre-program their VCRs for the week we're going to be living here.
Katzen tucked his laptop under his arm and rose.
I've got some material to get for the meeting, he said. See you folks in 15.
And then every quarter hour after that, Stoll said, following him out, until we're all old and gray. Alone now, the press officer sipped her espresso and contemplated the primary op center team. They were a bunch of characters, with Matt Stoll the biggest kid and Liz Gordon the biggest bully. But the best people in any field usually were eccentric, and getting them to work together in close quarters like this was a thankless job. The best Paul Hood could ever hope for among his eclectic officers was peaceful coexistence, shared purpose, and some degree of mutual professional respect. He got that through high-maintenance hands-on management, though she knew the toll that took on his private life. Leaving the cafeteria to go to the meeting, Anne ran into Martha McCall. The 49-year-old political officer and linguistics expert was also hurrying to the meeting, though she never seemed to be in a hurry. The daughter of the late soul singer Mac McCall, she had his cheek-splitting smile, smoky voice, and easy manner, layered atop her own core of steel. She always appeared cool, the result of having grown up on the road with her father, where she learned that drunks, rednecks, and bigots were more intimidated by a sharp mind and wit than by a sharp knife. When Mac was killed in a car crash, Martha went to live with an aunt who made her study hard, put her through college, and lived to see her make the move from her father's soul-to-go days to the State Department.
"Morning, Glory," Martha said as Anne increased her speed to keep up with the taller woman.
"Morning, Martha," Anne said. "I understand you had a busy night."
"Lowell and I did the Dance of the Seven Veils up on the hill," she said. "Those Congress people take a bit of persuading."
The two walked the rest of the way in silence. Martha was not one for small talk in any language, unless it was with the high and mighty. Increasingly, Anne had the feeling that if there was anyone who coveted Hood's job, it wasn't Mike Rogers. Mike Rogers, Bob Herbert, Matt Stoll, Phil Katzen and Liz Gordon were already sitting around the large oval conference table in the tank when Anne and Martha arrived. Anne noted that Bob Herbert appeared drawn. She assumed that he and his old friend Rogers had spent the night working on the Stryker mission, and dealing with some of the emotions the bombing had to have brought out in the wheelchair-bound intelligence officer. The women were followed in by Paul Hood and a hustling Lowell Coffey. Even before the attorney was in, Rogers had pressed a button in the side of the table and the heavy door had begun to shut. The small room was lit by fluorescent lights. On the wall across from where Rogers was sitting, the large digital countdown clock was frozen at zero. Whenever there was a crisis with a timetable, the clock was set and a similar readout appeared in every office, just so there was no mistake about when things had to be done. The walls, floor, door, and ceiling of the tank were all covered with mottled gray and black sound-absorbing acoustics. Behind this were several layers of cork, a foot of concrete, and more acoustics. Buried in the concrete on all six sides of the room were wire grids that generated vacillating audio waves. No electronic information could enter or leave the room without being completely and irreparably distorted. Hood sat at the head of the table. To his right, on a small extension, were a monitor and computer keyboard and telephone hookup. A tiny fiber-optic camera was attached to the top of the monitor and allowed him to see anyone on screen who had a similar setup. When the door was shut, Paul said, "I know we all feel sick about what happened yesterday, so there's no need to comment further about that. I want to thank Mike for the incredible job he did. He'll be telling you about that."
In case you haven't already heard, there's more to this story than has been on the news. I've come straight from a plane flight and a quick shower, so I'm as eager to hear what he has to say as you are. I'd like to point out, though, that everything you'll be hearing is Priority One clearance. When we leave here, both Mike and I, or Mike and Martha, have to sign off on anyone less than that who needs to be told. Hood looked at Rogers. Mike? Rogers thanked Hood, then briefed the team on what had happened in the Oval Office. He told them that Stryker had departed from Andrews at 4:47 a.m. and would arrive in Helsinki around 8:50 p.m. local time. Lowell, he said, where are we on the Finnish ambassador?
He's given me a temporary okay, the attorney said. He just needs a rubber stamp from the president.
When will we have that?
This morning, Coffey replied.
Rogers looked at his watch.
It's already 4 p.m. over there. Are you sure?
I'm sure. They start late and work late over there.
No one makes any high-level decisions until after lunch. Rogers looked from Coffey to Daryl McCaskey.
Assuming that we get what we want from the Finnish government, is there any way Interpol can help us with intelligence from St. Petersburg?
Well, that depends. You mean the Hermitage?
Rogers nodded.
Do I tell them about the English agent who was killed there the other day?
Rogers looked at Hood.
DI-6 lost a man there trying to eavesdrop on the TV studio.
Are we asking Interpol to do essentially the same kind of reconnaissance? Hood asked.
Rogers nodded again.
Then tell them about the Englishman, Hood said.
I'm sure there's a hot dog who'll be willing to take them on.
What about at the border? Rogers asked. If we have to go by land, is there any way the Finns can sneak our team across?
I suppose someone in the Ministry of Defense, McCaskey said, and I'll see what I can wangle. Just understand, Mike, there are less than 4,000 effectives in the Border Guard. They don't exactly want to go pissing off the Russians.
Understood, the deputy director said, then turned to Matt Stoll. The portly computer expert was tapping his steepled fingers together.
Matt, Rogers said, I want you to use your computer contacts to find out if the Russians have been ordering or stockpiling anything out of the ordinary, or if any of their top tech people have relocated to St. Petersburg in the last year.
Those guys are pretty tight-lipped, Stoll said. I mean, it's not like they have a lot of options in private industry if the government stops trusting them. But I'll try.
Don't try, do, Rogers snapped. Almost at once he looked down and rolled his lips together.
Sorry, he said after a moment. It's been a long night, Matt. I may have to send my team into Russia, and that won't be a day at the beach. I want them to know everything they can about their target and who they might encounter. Knowing something about the electronics will help a great deal.
I understand, Stoll said stiffly. I'll do some hacking, internetting, see what I can find.
Thank you, Rogers said.
Anne watched as the deputy director turned to Liz Gordon. She reacted with surprise when he spoke. Unlike Hood, who put little faith in psychological profiles of foreign leaders, Rogers trusted their validity.
Liz, he said, I want you to put Russian Interior Minister Dugin through the computer. Factor in his loss of the presidency to Zhanyin, as well as the influence of General Mikhail Kosygin. Bob has information on the general if you need it.
His name rings a bell, Martha said. I'm sure he's in my file.
Rogers turned to Environmental Officer Phil Katzen, who had his laptop open and ready.
Phil, I need a workup on the Gulf of Finland into the Neva, and the Neva where it passes the Hermitage. Temperature, speed, wind factor.
The computer to Hood's right beeped. He hit F6 to answer, then pushed Control to hold the call.
Rogers continued, and I want whatever you've got on the composition of the soil under the museum. I want to know how deep the Russians may have dug there.
Katzen nodded as he finished typing. Hood hit Control again. The face of his executive assistant, Stephen Bugs Benet, appeared on the screen.
"Sir," said Bugs, "there's an urgent call from Commander Hubbard at DI-6. It pertains to this matter, so I thought..."
"Thanks," said Hood. "Put it through."
Hood snapped on the phone's speaker button, then waited. The bloodhound face appeared on the monitor a moment later.
"Good morning, Commander," Hood said. "I'm with the rest of my team, so I took the liberty of putting you on the speakerphone."
"Fine," Hubbard said, his thickly accented voice deep and raspy. "I'll do the same. Mr. Hood, let me get straight to the matter. We have an operative here who would like to be part of the team you've sent to Helsinki."
Roger's expression soured. He shook his head. Hood said, Commander, ours is a carefully balanced unit.
I understand, Hubbard said, but hear me out. I've lost 2 agents and a 3rd is hiding. My staff wants me to send our Bengal unit in, but it wouldn't do to have our 2 groups stumbling one over the other.
Could your Bengal unit put me on the phone with the head of this new operation in St. Petersburg?
Pardon me, said Hubbard.
What I'm saying, said Hood, is that you're not offering me anything I can't get myself. We'll share what we find out, as always.
Of course, said Hubbard, but I disagree. We can offer you one thing, Miss Peggy James.
Hood quickly input Control-F5 on his keyboard to access agent files. He hit DI-6, typed James, and her dossier appeared. Rogers got up and stood behind Hood as he scanned the file, which was filled with data from DI-6 as well as independent information collected by OpCenter, the CIA, and other U.S. agencies. She has quite a record, Hood said. The granddaughter of a lord, 3 years in the field in South Africa, 2 in Syria, 7 at headquarters. Special forces training, speaks 6 languages, holds 4 commendations. Rebuilds and races vintage motorcycles. He stopped when Mike Rogers pointed to a cross-reference to another file.
Commander Hubbard, this is Mike Rogers, he said. I see that Ms. James also recruited Mr. Fields Hutton.
Yes, General, Hubbard admitted. They were very close.
Watch out for grudge matches, Liz muttered, shaking her head. Did you hear, Commander? Hood asked. That was our staff psychologist.
We heard, a sharp female voice replied. And I assure you, I'm not in this for revenge. I simply want to see that the job Keith started is finished.
No one is questioning your abilities, Agent James, Liz said in a strong, unapologetic voice that left no room for debate. But emotional detachment and objectivity fuel caution, and that's what we want in our...
Balls, snapped Peggy. Either I go with you, or I go in alone, but I am going.
That will be quite enough, Hubbard said firmly.
Coffee cleared his throat and folded his hands on the table.
Commander Hubbard, Agent James, I'm Lowell Coffee II, OpCenter's attorney.
He looked at Hood.
Paul, you're probably going to have my head for this, but I think you should consider their offer.
Hood's expression was unchanged, but Roger's eyes were wide and angry. Coffee avoided them.
Martha and I still have a few points to work out with the CIC, Coffee said. And if I can tell them that this is an international team, there's a much better chance we'll be able to bargain for things like more time, a larger geographical area, that sort of thing.
You'll want me to fall on my sword too, Mike, McCaskey said. But having Agent James on the team will help me too. The Finnish Minister of Defense is very close to Admiral Merrow of the Royal Marines. If we need other favors as this unfolds, he's the man we'll have to ask for them. The general said nothing for a long moment, and the silence from London was provocative. Hood finally looked at Bob Herbert. The intelligence chief's lips were pursed, and he was drumming the leather armrests of his wheelchair. Bob, Hood asked, what do you say? His soft voice, tinged with remnants of his Mississippi youth, Herbert said,
I say that we can get the job done just fine all by ourselves. If the lady wants to go in alone, that's Commander Hubbard's business. I don't see why we need to toss an extra gear into a finely tuned machine.
Martha McCall said,
I think we're getting dangerously territorial here. Agent James is a professional. She'll fit into your finely tuned machine.
Thank you, Peggy said, whoever you are.
Martha McCall, she said, political officer, and you're welcome. I know what it's like to be kept out of the boys' club.
That's bull, Herbert waved dismissively. This isn't about black, white, male, female, or hands across the goddamn water. We've already got one first-timer on this mission, Sandra Devone, the lady who took Bass Moore's place. All I'm saying is that we'd have to be crazy to take on another.
Another lady, you mean, Martha said.
Another rookie, Herbert shot back.
My God, when did every command decision become a mandate against somebody?
Hood said, Thanks for the suggestions, all of you. Commander, I hope you'll forgive us for talking about your person in front of her back.
I appreciate it, Peggy said. I've always liked to know where I stand.
Hood said. I have my reservations, but Lowell's right. A binational group makes sense, and Peggy seems to have the right stuff. Herbert drove his palms into the edge of the table and whistled the first few measures of It's a Small World. Rogers returned to his seat. His neck was flushed above the collar of his uniform, and his dark brow seemed even darker. I'll make sure you get the specifics as we do, Hood said, so that your agent can link up with Stryker. Needless to say, Commander, Stryker's leader, Lieutenant Colonel Squires, has our complete trust. I expect Agent James to follow his orders.
Of course, General, Commander Hubbard said, and thank you.
Hood looked at Rogers as the monitor winked off. Mike, Hood said, he was going to send her anyway. At least now we'll know where she is.
It was your call, Rogers replied. It's just not the one I would have made.
He looked at Hood.
This isn't D-Day or Desert Storm. We didn't need an international consensus. The United States was attacked, and the United States military was responding. Period.
Semicolon, Hood corrected. DI-6 suffered casualties as well. The information they gave us reinforced our suspicions about the target. They deserve a shot at that target.
As I told you, we don't agree on that, Rogers said. Miss James had to be disciplined by her own superior. She's certainly not going to listen to Squires. But you're back, and you're in command.
He looked around the table.
I've finished everything on my agenda. Thank you, everyone, for your attention.
Hood also looked around. Any other business?
Yes, said Herbert.
I think Mike Rogers and Lynn Dominick and Karen Wong deserve friggin' medals for the silk purse they made from a sow's ear last night. While everyone else in the country was running around wringing their hands about the explosion, those three figured out who did it and probably why. Instead of a purple heart, though, we just kicked Mike in the pants. I'm sorry, but I just don't get it.
Because we disagree with him, said Lowell Coffey, that doesn't mean we think any less of what he did.
You're tired and PO'd, Bob, said Liz Gordon. This wasn't about Mike. It was about living in the world of today. Herbert grumbled his disapproval of the world of today as he rolled away from the table. Hood rose. I'll contact you all individually during the morning to check on your progress, he said. Then he looked at Mike Rogers. Once again, in case anyone missed it, no one in this room could have done the job that Mike did last night. Rogers gave him a little nod, then buzzed open the door and followed Bob Herbert from the tank. Chapter 19, Monday, 8 p.m., St. Petersburg. As the digital clock in the corner of the computer monitor rolled over from 7:59:59, a change came over the operations center. The blue hue that had filled the room from the more than 24 computer screens was replaced by a flood of changing colors which were reflected on the faces and clothes of everyone in the room. The mood changed, too. Though no one applauded, the release of tension was palpable as the center came alive.
Operations Support Officer Fyodor Buriba looked at Orlov from his lone console on a table tucked into the front right corner. A smile broke through the young man's neatly trimmed black beard, and his dark eyes gleamed.
We have 100% go, sir, he said.
Sergei Orlov was standing in the middle of the large, low-ceilinged room, his hands locked behind his back as his eyes ranged from screen to screen.
Thank you, Mr. Buriba, Orlov said. And well done, everyone. All stations, double-check your data before we inform Moscow that the countdown to operations has begun.
Olaf began walking slowly from side to side, looking over the shoulders of his staff.
The 24 computers and monitors were arranged in a semicircle on a tightly curved, nearly horseshoe-shaped tabletop. Each monitor was manned by an operator, and he relaxed a little at 8 p.m. exactly, as the blue of each screen was replaced by a stream of data, photographs, maps, or charts. 10 of the monitors were dedicated to satellite surveillance. 4 were tapped into a worldwide intelligence database that included reports legal as well as hacked from police departments, embassies, and government agencies. 9 others were hooked to radios and cellular telephones and received reports from operatives around the world. And 1 was linked directly to the office of the ministers in the Kremlin, including Dugin. This link was manned by Corporal Yevashin, who was handpicked by Colonel Roski and reported directly to him.
All but the map screens were filled with phrases in code. The words meant nothing to Orloff, to the person at the next monitor, or to anyone else in the center. Each station had its own code so that the damage a mole might cause would be minimized. In the event that an operative was sick, a codebreaker program could be activated by both Orloff and Roski, each of whom knew half of the two-part password. When the screens came to life after weeks of checking and debugging, Orloff felt the same he had each time one of the huge rockets roared to life beneath him. Relief that everything came on, as scheduled. Though his life wasn't at risk the way it was every time he rode a rocket, the truth was he had never contemplated life or death as he rode into space. That wasn't what exploration or being a fighter pilot or even living from day to day was about. His reputation was more important than his life, and Orloff's only thought ever was that he'd do his best and not screw up. The front wall of the room was covered with a world map. Images from any of the screens could be superimposed on it using a projector set in the ceiling. On the side walls were shelves of diskettes and backups, top-secret data, files, and records about governments, the military, and agencies from around the world. In the center of the back wall was a door that led to the hallway, and the cryptanalysis center, security room, mess, lavatory, and exit. Doors to Orloff's and Roski's offices were on the right and left, respectively. Standing in the heart of the center, Orloff felt as if he were commanding a ship of the future, one that went nowhere yet had the ability to look down from the heavens or peer under rocks on the earth, one that could know nearly anything about almost anyone in a moment. Even when he was in outer space, with the earth turning slowly beneath him, he had never felt this omniscient. And because every government required accurate, timely intelligence, his funding and the operation of the center had been unaffected by the chaos in many quarters of Russia. He almost understood how Tsar Nicholas II must have felt, living in splendid isolation until the end came. It was easy to be in a place like this and feel cut off from the day-to-day problems of others, and Orloff made sure to pick up 3 or 4 different newspapers every day so as not to lose touch with reality. Corporal Yavashin suddenly stood, faced the general, and snapped off a salute. He removed his headset and held it out.
"General, sir," he said, "the radio room reports a private communication for you."
"Thank you," Orloff said, waving away the headset. "I'll take it in my office." He turned and headed toward the door on the far right. Entering his personal code on the keypad to the left of the door, Orloff entered. His assistant, Nina Tyareva, poked her head from behind a divider in a back corner of the room. A stately, broad-shouldered woman of 35, she was dressed in a tight-fitting navy blue jacket and skirt. She had chestnut hair, worn in a bun, large eyes, a handsomely arched nose, and a deep, diagonal furrow along her forehead, where a bullet had creased her skull. A former officer of the St. Petersburg Police Force, she also carried scars on her chest and right arm, the result of having stood her ground to bring down 2 men during an attempted bank robbery.
"Congratulations, General," she said.
"Thanks," Orloff replied as he shut the door. "But we've still got several 100 checkpoints to go."
"I know,"
Nina said.
"And when we pass those, you won't be happy until we've put a successful day behind us, and then a week, and then a year."
"What's life without new goals?" the general asked as he sat behind his desk, a black acrylic surface on 4 thin white legs, made from the remains of one of the Vostok boosters that had carried him into space. The rest of the room was decorated with photographs, models, awards, and mementos of his years in space, including a display case with his prize possession, a switch panel from the crewed capsule that had carried Yuri Gagarin on the first manned flight into outer space. He sat in a leather-upholstered bucket chair, swung it in front of the computer, and typed in his access code. The screen quickly filled with the back of Interior Minister Dogin's head.
"Minister," Orloff said into a condenser microphone built into the lower left corner of the monitor.
It was several seconds before Dogin turned around. Orloff wasn't sure whether the minister liked making people wait for him, or whether he didn't like to appear to be waiting for others. In either case, it was a game, and Orloff didn't like it. The minister smiled.
"Corporal Yavashin tells me that everything went on as planned."
"The corporal was out of line, not to mention premature," Orloff said. "We haven't reviewed the data as yet."
"I'm sure it will check out," Dogin said. "And don't be hard on the corporal for his enthusiasm, General.
This is a great day for the entire team.
The entire team? Orloff rolled the phrase over in his mind. When he was working in the space program, a team was a group of dedicated people working toward a single goal, expanding human capabilities in space. There was a political agenda, but the importance of the work itself made that seem almost trivial. Orloff didn't have a team here. He had several of them, all pulling in opposite directions. There was a group working to get the center online, another group sneaking information to Dugin, and even a team of paranoid in-betweeners headed by Security Director Glinka, desperate to determine which of the other teams they should be supporting. It might very well cost him his command, but Orloff promised himself that this place would work as a team.
"As it happens," Dugin said, "we couldn't have timed the countdown better. There's a Gulfstream jet moving through the South Pacific toward Japan. After refueling in Tokyo, the jet will fly on to Vladivostok. I'll have my assistant send the flight path through to you. I want the center to monitor the plane's progress. The pilot has instructions to contact you after he lands in Vladivostok, which will be at approximately 5 in the morning local time. When he does, let me know and I'll give you further instructions to radio to him."
"Is this a test of our system?" Orloff asked.
"No, General. The cargo on the Gulfstream is of vital importance to this office."
"In that case, sir," Orloff said, "until everything here has been thoroughly checked, why not let air defense handle it? Their radio and electronic technical forces would be..."
"Extraneous and obtrusive," Dugin said. He smiled. "I want you to follow the plane, General. I'm confident that the center can handle it. Any and all communications from the aircraft will come to your radio room in code, of course, and any problems or delays will be reported to me directly by you or by Colonel Roski. Do you have any questions?"
"Several, sir," Orloff admitted, "but I'll log the order and do as you ask." He entered a command, which automatically recorded the date and time, and a window opened in the bottom of the screen. He typed, "Minister Dugin orders monitoring of Gulfstream jet bound for Vladivostok." He reread it and hit the save button. It beeped to show that the save had been successful.
"Thank you, General," said Dugin. "All your questions will be answered in time. Now, good luck with the countdown. I look forward to hearing that the jewel in our intelligence crown is fully operational in less than 3 hours."
"Yes, sir," Orloff said. "Though I wonder, who's wearing that crown?"
Dugin was still smiling. "I'm disappointed, General. Impertinence doesn't suit you."
"My apologies," Orloff said. "I find it disturbing myself. But I've never been asked to run a mission with incomplete information or untested equipment, nor have I been in a situation where subordinates feel free to break the chain of command."
"We must all grow and change," Dugin said. "Let me remind you of something Stalin said in his speech to the Russian people in July 1941. There must be no room in our ranks for whimperers and cowards, for panic-mongers and deserters. Our people must know no fear."
"You are a courageous and reasonable man, General. Trust me, and I assure you, your faith will be rewarded." Dugin pressed a button, and his image winked out. Staring at the dark screen, Orloff was not surprised by the rebuke, though Dugin's answer hardly put him at ease. If anything, it caused him to wonder if he had trusted too much in Dugin. He found himself contemplating the world war that had prompted Stalin's speech, and to wonder, with alarm he tried hard to suppress, if Minister Dugin somehow imagined Russia to be at war, and if so, with whom?
Chapter 20. Tuesday, 3:05 a.m., Tokyo. Simon Jet Li, Honolulu-born and raised, resolved to devote his life to police work on August 24, 1967. On that day, at the age of 7, he watched as his father, who was a hulking movie extra, acted in a scene with Jack Lord and James MacArthur on their TV series Hawaii Five-O. He wasn't sure whether it was Lord's intensity or the fact that he was able to manhandle his father that gave him the police bug, though it was the habit of dyeing his hair jet black, like Lord's, that gave him his nickname. Whatever the reason, Lee joined the FBI in 1983, graduated third in his class at the academy, and returned to Honolulu as a fully-fledged agent. Twice he'd turned down promotions so he could stay in the field and do what he loved, hunt down bad guys and make the world a cleaner place. Which was why he was in Tokyo, working undercover as an airline mechanic with the blessings of the Japanese self-defense forces. Raw drugs were going from South America to Hawaii to Japan, and with his partner in Honolulu, Lee was tracking the private planes as they came and went, looking for likely suspects. The Gulfstream III was a very likely suspect. Lee's partner in Hawaii had tracked the Gulfstream from Colombia, and it was registered to a company that was owned by a baked goods distributor in New York. Ostensibly, it was carrying ingredients used to make the distributor's specialty exotic bagels. Awakened in his room at the inn just a 5-minute drive from the airport, Lee had called his partner, JSDF Sergeant Ken Sawara, and hurried over. Lee listened to the tower through his headset as he played around with the JT3D7 turbofan in the corner of the hangar at the airfield. After 2 weeks of tinkering with the same engine, he felt he knew it better than anyone at Pratt & Whitney. The Gulfstream touched down and was due for a quick turnaround before heading to Vladivostok. That made it even more suspicious, Lee thought, since the baked goods distributor was thought to be tied to the Russian mafia. Feeling a bit constricted in the bulletproof vest he wore under his white jumpsuit, Lee set down his wrench and walked to the phone on the hangar wall. He felt the lopsided weight of the holstered 38 Smith & Wesson press against his left shoulder as he punched Ken's mobile number into the green phone. "Ken," he said, "the Gulfstream just landed and is pulling up to Hangar 2. Meet me there." Ken Sawara said, "Let me check it out." "No, but your Japanese is terrible, Jet. Your Colombian is worse," said Lee. "See you there." It was well before sunrise, and though the airport was not as busy as the one in Honolulu had been over 6 hours before at 2:35 p.m. local time, it was busy enough as air traffic converged from the west and the east. Lee knew that many mobsters, men like Aram Vonyev and Dmitry Shovich, liked having their planes land at big public airports rather than at the small strips that government agents found easier to watch. Those two criminals especially liked having their planes come and go during the day, out in the open, where law officers and rival gangsters didn't expect to see them. In Honolulu, as in Mexico City, and in Bogota, Colombia, before that, this plane had landed and taken off in bright daylight. The Gulfstream taxied quickly to the Yasue oil truck waiting near the hangar nearest to the runway. Here, as at the other fields, the Gulfstream had its own fuel trucks waiting. Though mobsters had their own reasons for moving goods somewhat out in the open like this, none was so brazen that he wanted to stay on the ground any longer than absolutely necessary. If the plane followed the pattern, and there was no reason it shouldn't, Lee knew, then after less than 50 minutes on the ground in Tokyo, it would be airborne again, its twin Rolls-Royce Spey MK-511-8 turbofans, carrying it to the northwest into the dark, overcast skies. Soon it would be in Russia, just across the Sea of Japan. Brushing the longish black hair from his forehead, Lee pulled a purchase order from his pocket and pretended to read it. He whistled as he walked onto the dark tarmac. He saw the winking lights of the small jet as it rolled toward the hangar for refueling, its tanks nearly empty after the 4,500-mile journey. He watched as the ground crew rolled the hose from the tank, and Lee knew then that the plane was carrying contraband. The crew was working faster, with more serious efficiency than usual. They'd been paid off. From the corner of his eye, he saw car lights. That would be Sawara. As planned, he'd pull off to the side and wait just in case Lee needed backup. The FBI agent intended to walk up to the plane, tell the crew foreman he was told to check for a faulty fuel switch, and while they took up the issue with the pilot, he'd swing inside and have a poke around the cargo. The Toyota pulled up beside Lee, pacing him. Lee stopped, confused, as he looked down at the driver's side window. Then the window rolled down, showing Sawara's expressionless face. "Can I help you?" Lee said to Sawara in Japanese, though with his wide eyes and a severely pinched brow, he was actually asking, "What the hell are you doing?" In response, Sawara lifted the .38 Special Model 60 revolver from his lap and pointed it at Lee. With speed and instincts that were uncanny, the agent dropped flat to his back on the tarmac an instant before the gun flashed. Yanking his own .38 from its holster, Lee swung it across his chest and shot out the passenger side front tire, then rolled to his right as Sawara tried to back away for another shot. The bare rim sparked and screamed as he slammed the car into reverse, one hand on the steering wheel, the other still holding the gun out the window. His second shot caught Lee in the right thigh.
"The turncoat bastard," Lee thought as he put three bullets through the car door.
Each shell entered with a dull clung, and Sawara's third and fourth shots flew wild as Lee's bullets struck him. With a moan, the Japanese soldier arched to the left, toward the window, then his forehead drooped against the steering wheel. The car sped up, turning at crazy angles as the wounded man's foot sat heavily on the pedal. At least it was moving away from him, and Lee watched as it collided with an empty luggage cart. The Toyota rode up on the side of the cart, crunching it down and going nowhere as the tires were lifted off the ground. Lee's wound felt like a hellish muscle cramp, sunburn hot to the bone and brutally tight from his thigh to his knee. It was impossible to move his leg without sending a sheet of pain from his heel to his neck. Craning his head around, Lee looked at the plane some 200 yards away. The underbelly of the fuselage was flashing white and dark from the lights, and the ground crew continued their work, though now 2 men had appeared in the open doorway. Both were dressed in dungarees and sweatshirts, and neither man carried a gun. Either they weren't stupid, Lee thought, or they were. The 2 men ducked back into the plane, shouting at one another. Lee knew that they'd be returning soon, and mustering his will, he flopped onto his belly, got onto his left knee, and climbed to his feet. He winced with pain as he began hopping forward, unable to put weight on his right leg without causing a burst of white light to erupt behind his eyes.